Good evening, everybody. Is this working?
Yes.
Good evening, and welcome to the fourth lecture in our series, Astronomy of the 21st Century, a distinguished lecture series which is celebrating the International Year of Astronomy 2009 as part of the LSA theme semester on the universe, yours to discover. I'm Sally Uwe from the Department of Astronomy, and we have Gary Foreman, the President of the Student Astronomical Society, a member of UAC, and Amy Harris, the Director of the Exhibit Museum of Natural History. And in addition to these units, the series is also generously supported by the Michigan Center for Theoretical Physics. If you're new to the theme semester activities, we really encourage you to check out everything that we have to offer, which is considerable, at our website, which is in the upper right-hand corner there, www.lsa.umich.edu/universe. And one of the highlights upcoming soon is Bertolt Brecht's play, Galileo, that is going to be put on in the residential college at the end of this month. And then the final lecture in this series will be our own Fred Adams speaking on April 3rd on the future of our universe. So before we get started, could I please remind everyone also to silence your cell phones? Thanks. This evening, we are so honored to have with us Professor Joseph Taylor from Princeton University, a Nobel laureate. Professor Taylor did his undergraduate work at Haverford College before moving on to Harvard University, where he completed his doctorate in 1968. He is a radio astronomer who specializes in neutron stars and gravity, and he's best known for his Nobel Prize-winning discovery in 1974 of a binary neutron star, the importance of which will be apparent to you after this evening's lecture. Professor Taylor then moved on after his graduate work to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where he was on the faculty until 1980, whereupon he moved to Princeton and has stayed there ever since. He is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, and in addition to the Nobel Prize, he has won numerous other awards, including the Henry Draper Medal of the National Academy of Sciences, the Wolf Prize in Physics, and he is also a MacArthur Fellow. Professor Taylor's advice and expertise is widely sought after, and a notable example is that he was a co-chair of the most recent Astronomy and Astrophysics Decade Review in 2000, which set the priorities for the entire field of astronomy and astrophysics during that period. So it's truly a pleasure and a privilege to have him with us this evening.
Well, thank you very much, Sally, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me attend to a couple of AV details here, and then we'll get started. So it's a great pleasure to be with you and to be back on your campus again the last couple of days. It's been, I think I counted up correctly, 14 years since I was here last, and that's too long. I've always enjoyed my visits here, and it's wonderful to have been here again today. Spent a lot of time talking with faculty and students in both physics and astronomy departments. So it's a great pleasure to give one of these lectures as part of this wonderful series that you have been having and will have still one more installment of after this evening. My plan this evening is to try to give you the flavor of an astrophysical experiment that I and a few others have been involved with for over a number of years, but starting with this discovery made in 1974, as you just heard, of a pulsar, the nature of which I will say more in just a few minutes. let me see, Mr. Gates has something else to tell us here. All right, so the plan more or less is as shown in this slide. I want to give you a little bit of historical background first. I noticed the title of the lecture series here is Astronomy of the 21st Century, but in fact, it's good to have these things put into historical context, and I'm going to start in more like 1470 or something like that and try to bring you up to the present before getting on with things that are much more recent. And I noticed that Fred Adams, your own Fred Adams, who will be speaking next, is basically talking about everything from here on out to the future, so not quite 21st century necessarily either. Anyway, then I'll give you a brief introduction to these objects, fascinating astronomical objects known as pulsars. I will show you some choice photographs of my favorite radio telescope in all the world, the one in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, where this discovery and most of the follow-up observations of this object were made. I then will tell you specifically about this binary pulsar timing experiment, which it turns out is a clock comparison experiment, where the pulsar is one of the clocks, and the other clock is the very best standard of atomic time that we can bring to bear on the problem here on the Earth. Atomic time standards can be extremely precise, but they are no more than good enough for an experiment like the one that I'll be describing. And I'll say just a few words about what's next in the area of gravitational physics that may be of interest to some of you who are going on, perhaps in a field closely related to some of these things. So gravity is one of the fundamental forces of nature. There are only four that we know about. Gravity is one, electromagnetism is another, and then there are two different kinds of nuclear forces. Gravity is the only one of these forces that we ordinarily feel in normal circumstances. I can feel my own weight holding me on the floor. If I pick up something heavy, it's easy to feel the gravitational attraction that the Earth has on that. It's also true that everything that we have and use, and indeed ourselves, are held together by electromagnetic forces, but we don't feel those ordinarily because there are equal and opposite amounts of electrical charge in everything, and so the net effect of all of it on other objects is zero, because the positive and negative electrical forces tend to cancel out. Of course, it is just those electrical forces which hold atoms together, so they're very important. They have everything to do with chemistry, for example. But on a large scale, large distances, gravity, although it is the weakest one by a large factor of all of these fundamental forces of nature, is the only one that matters when it comes to holding together things like the Earth or the Moon or the Sun, or indeed make galaxies the way they are, and the whole universe structure is dominated by gravity. So it's important to understand gravity, and we've been busy doing that for all of recorded history and beyond, I'm sure. Even in prehistoric times, gravity was obviously important. People had to get things from here to there and carry them and all that kind of thing. So let's think just a little bit. We have to start somewhere, and I thought something like 500 years ago was maybe a good place to start. Copernicus, as you know, was the first one to recognize and to make sort of in what in modern terms we would call a physical theory, describing the relative positions and motions of the objects which we now make up our solar system, the things which orbit around the sun. That wasn't known before Copernicus's time. He recognized that the observations of the ancient Greeks and the Arabic civilizations in the European Middle Ages all pointed to tracks of objects in the sky, the moving planets against the more or less fixed background of stars, which could be much more easily understood if the hypothesis were true that the sun is at the center of all this system of objects and the Earth and the planets move around the sun. That was a new idea then. It depended on accurate observations, most of which were not made by Copernicus himself, but by people before him, and indeed were strengthened greatly by people soon after him, including Tycho Brahe, a Danish very careful observer, made accurate observations, tabulated positions of planets year after year. This is also about the same time as Galileo, really the father of modern experimental physics, was beginning to recognize that some of these things that had been mysterious to people in the past could be understood in terms of basic principles and even mathematical equations. Soon, at about this time also, came along Kepler, who, emboldened by and enriched by the vast detail of the astronomical observations made by Tycho, actually worked out that the shapes of the planetary orbits could be understood in three-dimensional space if they were the shapes of ellipses with the sun located at one of the focal points of the ellipse. And he did, famous laws of planetary motion derived by Kepler exemplify that and the varying rates of speed at which the planets move depending on their position in these elliptical orbits. Now, not long after this came along Newton, who made what many have described as the greatest scientific generalization of all time, to recognize that the very same force which makes an apple fall from the tree or a baseball fall from your hand when you drop it is the force which holds the moon in its orbit around the Earth and the Earth-Moon system in an orbit around the Sun, that force, the force of the universal law of gravitation, can be understood as a even with a mathematical equation. The magnitude of the force is proportional to the product of the two the masses of the two objects and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. An extraordinarily powerful theoretical deduction based on astronomical observations made before his time. Now, not too long after Newton made that immense start, in some sense, Newton and Galileo and all of this stuff marks the origin of modern science, modern physical science. Not too long after that time, Benjamin Franklin, here in the New World now, was experimenting with electricity in very detailed ways. Electricity was not a phenomenon known well at that time in any form, but it was possible to make large electrical charges and to discharge things and to store charge in what we would now call capacitors. Franklin made fascinating experiments with it. I think flying the kite in the thunderstorm, he was lucky he got out alive, but if he did that, but many other experiments. And not too long afterwards, many other people were beginning to look into these phenomena in some detail as well. Michael Faraday, for example, in England, began to recognize that there was a very close observable connection between electrical currents flowing in a conductor, a wire or something, and magnetic forces. He could deflect the needle of a compass by allowing a current to flow. He could produce so-called induction effects. And at roughly the same time, Joseph Henry, then at my university in Princeton, was experimenting and making electromagnets. Joseph Henry made an electromagnet which still exists in a display case in the front of our physics building, which was, he proved, able to lift 1 ton of undergraduates off the floor. That's pretty impressive. Of course, he had some levers and so forth in there as well, but this was an electromagnet, something which had never been built before about that time. He built a telegraph as well, but Samuel Morse gets credit for inventing the telegraph. Henry had one, and he used it to allow his housekeeper to send him a message that it was time to come to lunch. But Henry was a professor. He wasn't too interested in these commercialization things. He was interested in the details, and he never commercialized this discovery of what, in effect, was a telegraph. the unit of inductance is, of course, now referred to as the Henry. The unit of electrical capacitance is the Faraday. These are the good reasons for those things. Not too long after that, James Clerk Maxwell came along. Oh, here's Joseph Henry on the statue in front of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. Just interesting. When he left Princeton University, he went and was the first founding director of the Smithsonian. here's another sidelight. Read that slowly. Queen Victoria asks Michael Faraday, "Of what use is your discovery of this connection between electricity and magnetism?" And Faraday is apparently supposed to have responded, "Of what use is a newborn baby?" I think that sort of question is always asked by a news reporter or something. Okay, you've discovered gravity waves. What are they good for? And we never know, and typically, that kind of a discovery in fundamental science. It might turn out to be useful, it might not, or we might not discover how it could be useful for many decades or even centuries afterwards. It turns out it wasn't very long after Faraday and Henry's day that electricity began to be used for more or less everything. We made motors and generators and streetcars and elevators and cell phones, and our whole society runs on this stuff now. So it didn't take that long. Maxwell came along and did to electricity and magnetism more or less what Newton had done for gravitational interactions. Maxwell recognized that all of these phenomena that had been studied by Franklin, Faraday, Henry, and of course many others that I didn't have time to say anything about could be understood in mathematical form. It could be understood, in fact, in four very concise, relatively simple either integral or differential equations. Physics majors can wear these equations on their t-shirts, and they often do. There are four basic equations that everybody who studies physics learns today, and they describe effectively everything there is to know about ordinary classical electromagnetism. Their output has been extraordinarily rich in what it has produced. Not too long after that, Heinrich Hertz, who came along and recognized that Maxwell's equations predicted the existence of electromagnetic radiation waves. They, in fact, suggested very strongly that light is a form of electromagnetic radiation because the equations that Maxwell had derived include the an expression that can be solved for the velocity at which these waves would propagate. And it was easy to see that that predicted velocity was, within the experimental errors, equal to the already measured velocity of light. So Hertz recognized that this meant that there should be an existence of electromagnetic waves with other frequencies, in particular lower frequencies than the frequency of light. And Hertz, in that sense, is the father of radio technology. He generated radio waves on one side of the laboratory and picked them up on the other side of the laboratory and basically created this whole field of wireless communication, if you like, that we're still seeing the explosion of even to this day. Marconi came along a few years afterwards. I don't think I have a picture of him here. Now, Einstein, just a few years after Hertz and those discoveries, came along and recognized that there were some inconsistencies between the Maxwellian description of electromagnetism, the Newtonian description of gravity, and other things that Einstein began to recognize almost certainly must intervene and prevent those sets of equations of Maxwell and Newton from being the last word on the subject in those areas. And part of the problem was that when things begin to move very rapidly, approaching the speed of light, Einstein recognized that there would be problems. He recognized that gravitation did not quite predict the motion of all of the planets accurately. It was remarkably accurate, but it was not precise enough to, for example, account for a small anomaly in the motion of our innermost planet in the solar system, the planet Mercury. And Einstein came up with his theory of gravity, a much more comprehensive and detailed theory that is the best theory of gravity we have to this day. It is not necessarily, by the way, the very last word that we will ever know about gravitation, but it's the best theory that we have now for describing all of those phenomena. Now, that's the end of the historical discussion that I wanted to begin with this evening, and let us move on and do some astronomy. I mentioned that this is the experimental work that I want to describe has to do with a pulsar. And I mentioned that a pulsar is an object born in a supernova explosion. Here is the remains of a supernova that exploded a bit more than, just slightly under 1,000 years ago, in the year 1054. It was observed, this was the Middle Ages in Europe. Probably people there observed it, they must have, but civilization there was not in a particular mode for recording this sort of phenomenon as a scientific inquiry. So there aren't actually very many European records of it. There are plenty of good records in the Far East. The Chinese, the Koreans observed it. American Indians apparently observed it and made records in caves that have been deciphered since that time. In any case, this star blew up. It left behind something in the center of that photograph. You can see two bright objects right here in the center, and one of them, it turns out, is a rapidly spinning, strongly magnetized neutron star, which, in fact, is what a pulsar is. If you spin a magnet rapidly, it is basically an electrical generator. It generates large voltages along the directions, along the magnetic field lines coming out of the north and south magnetic poles, and those give rise to radio noise, which is channeled outwards along the directions of those beams that are shown in such a way that as the star spins, this beam sweeps around the sky, and as a radio astronomer some long way away, perhaps pointed toward this object, you would pick up a blip of radio noise each time the thing goes around. And that's what gives the object the name pulsar. We receive pulses of radiation. And I've got three, for many purposes, you can get a better feeling for what these objects are like. by listening to them instead of letting me talk about them. So I've got three very brief audio clips here of different noises made by different pulsars. This first one spins pretty slowly. Do we have the audio turned on? Push it again. Okay, each time it turns around, you hear a blip. Let me play the next one. That one was spinning about every 3/4 of a second. You've got a pulse. This next one is quite a bit faster, about 11 pulses per second. Now, let me back up to that. Interestingly, you could hear what seemed to be a little bit of a syncopation to the beat from time to time there. The pulses are not all the same strength. In fact, some are even missing, or almost missing. They're very weak. But the spacing between them is very precise and is regulated by the simple rotation of this object in free space. Nothing is touching it. Nothing is slowing it down much. And so it basically acts like a very accurate clock. The final one on here for many years was the fastest pulsar known. It rotates about 642 times per second. That's a note well above middle C on the piano. So it's a high-pitched audio tone. It sounds like this. Okay. So there's no point in playing it any longer. It just sounds the same. So it's a rapidly spinning magnet. It is a very dense object. We now know that these objects have a mass about 1.4 times the mass of our sun, but a radius only about 10 kilometers. So the whole diameter of this thing, 20 kilometers, it's basically the size of a modest-sized city, not very big. It's got in that region more mass by 40% than our whole sun. So this is extremely dense matter. A teaspoonful of this matter weighs about 1 billion tons on the Earth. So this is not atomic matter. It is nuclear matter. It has been squeezed so much by gravitational forces that the empty space, which makes up most of an atom between the cloud of electrons and the very dense nucleus, is crushed out of existence. A physicist would say that it has become energetically favorable for the electrons to recombine with positively charged nuclear particles, the protons, to make neutrons. And so the neutron star is mostly made out of neutron material. It's got this strong magnetic field. It spins rapidly, and they're just fascinating objects. By the way, I'm showing you a sort of sketch of what a pulsar must be like with its the way a physicist would do with the major features indicated. But there is no such thing as a photograph of a pulsar. They're far too small to see and resolve with any existing or even future likely telescope of any kind. So unless we have space travel and can fly close to one of them, we're never going to see a surface or anything like that. Now, these observations, then, are of the radio waves emitted by pulsars, and so you need a radio telescope and a big one. The signals are weak, and the biggest radio telescope in the world for many years has been the fixed reflecting surface antenna in the northwest corner of the island of Puerto Rico. This is an aerial photograph taken of that Arecibo telescope. It's very rugged terrain, as you can see. Those are hills and mountains, and in fact, as a geologist would tell you, that's karst country. It is places where the ordinary level of the ground has fallen in a number of places, making these huge sinkholes because of the heavy tropical rainfall dissolving limestone underground and creating large caves which eventually cave in. And the telescope was built there for two reasons. One, because the U.S. Air Force, building it in the early 1960s, wanted it to be not too far from the equator for reasons that were of interest to their studies of atmospheric physics and to have the planets in view most of the time. And secondly, it was built there because these natural holes in the ground were just about the right size and shape to build a big reflecting telescope without doing a whole lot of earthwork. So up closer at least, it looks like this. It's a telescope that is 1,000 feet in diameter across it. So it's a fifth of a mile across. It's just a huge structure. The technology of putting it together is more or less the same as used for building suspension bridges, right? You've got these tall rigid towers with cables holding up the structure up here at the top, which upon which incoming radio waves, after being reflected by the bowl, are focused up there near the top. A few other photographs here, just for fun. It's possible to walk down into the valley floor below the telescope, and the surface, the reflecting surface, is made of perforated aluminum panels with lots of holes in it. The holes are sort of an eighth of an inch or so in size, so the rainfall goes right through, and ordinary vegetation grows in the valley floor below it. There are tie-down cables, as you can see, that go to these concrete pillars that are holding the structural members in place. The accuracy of the surface of this 1,000-foot diameter reflector is about 2 millimeters, the root mean square accuracy. So it's a very smooth surface on the scale of the wavelengths of radio waves that it's picking up, which are anywhere from a few centimeters up to many meters in length. So it's a fantastically sensitive instrument. At the focal arrangement, things are arranged in such a way that incoming radiation is focused onto one or more antennas up here at the focus, and those can move. So although the main mirror does not move, there's a pivot point at the center here and a circular track around which this big sort of banana-shaped structure rotates. And off on one end here is one kind of receiving antenna, and inside this radome are a whole bunch of other receiving antennas. It's of some interest to note that the 26-meter diameter radio telescope that Professor Aller and others here at this university have used for many years could fit inside this radome. It's sort of like that telescope upside down in there, acting as a secondary reflector on this telescope to observe the primary emissions. If movie buffs in here may remember that one of the James Bond films it involved this instrument where James Bond chases the bad guy down on here, and they go down actually on this thing. So you may have seen that in the movies sometime in the past. When you go up on the structure at the top, I mean, here we are up on this structure. You can ride a cable car up from the lab up to here. I often go up there with my graduate students after a night's observing to watch the sun come up. And from the top looking down, it looks like this. We're looking here off to the north, and about 15 miles away is the coast. This is the Atlantic Ocean. If we keep going in that direction, we get to Portugal before too long. And otherwise, we're looking at this sort of semi-jungle here around the telescope facility. You can actually walk down from the triangle where we just looked a minute ago, down along this catwalk to get back down to the ground. That's kind of fun as well. There are nice rails and fences on both sides, so you don't feel too much as though you're up there with no protection. Here's looking up into the radome. Sensitive receivers would be located frequently inside electronics cabin in that area. Also, some very powerful transmitters. This telescope is sometimes used not only to receive natural radiation from the sky, but to transmit pulses of very powerful radio waves outward to be reflected from the moon or planets to study the planetary surfaces. One can find out a lot by radar astronomy techniques in that way, and this has been one of the instruments that has been most productive in that area as well. At night, it's very beautiful. It looks something like that. Anyway, it's been a facility that has been extremely productive over years, and I've spent a great deal of my own experimental time there. Now, here's a photograph from 1974, the month of October. This was 1 month after the discovery of the binary pulsar that I'm going to be talking about. And this is the man, Russell Hulse, then my graduate student, who shared the Nobel Prize with me 20 years later. I can tell any of you faculty members who are here that it's a wonderful feeling, both at the time and in retrospect, to think that your very first graduate student would work on a project that would win a Nobel Prize. Anyway, Russ is a... he was a terrific student. We had a lot of fun working together on this project. And he went off after finishing his thesis and worked in rather different areas of physics in future. But he's, of course, been very much aware of the fascinating results that came as a result of the discovery that he took a major part in. Some of the equipment there is of some interest, and I'll just say a few things about it. He's working with keying in the bootstrap loader or something for what was the computer in our experiment. So those of you who do things with computers these days, which is probably everybody, will be amused that we used to call this a mini computer. had a very clunky old electronic typewriter as an input device, and the data were all, we didn't have a disk drive on this computer, they were too expensive, so we had this thing with magnetic tapes. If you look at the case that the tape drive is in, it looks like plywood, and indeed it is. The plywood was the shipping crate that we sent it down to Puerto Rico in from the University of Massachusetts. When we got there, we just took off the front of the crate and stood it up and never bothered to take the rest of it off. You might notice up in this corner a series of marks. Those are, in fact, hash marks. He's going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so forth for all the new pulsars that he's discovered. The nature of his project was to attempt to discover a large number of these pulsars, objects that had been discovered first in Cambridge, England, just a few years before. At this time that we began, there were only a couple dozen of them known, and we thought that with this automated system, with a computer and so forth, which is the first time that that kind of a technique had been applied to this sort of problem, we might be able to double the number of known pulsars, or perhaps even more than that. We were hoping to be able to delineate where they are found within our galaxy, and therefore how they might be related to other types of stars, and how they would fit into the general scheme of stellar and galactic evolution. We also mentioned in the very brief proposal that I had made to the National Science Foundation for the $20,000 that we needed to buy this computer, that it would be particularly important if we could find even one example of a pulsar orbiting another star, a so-called binary pulsar, because if we could, then we could measure the mass of a neutron star and a whole bunch of other interesting things. And that was not a central part of the rationale for this proposal, but in fact, we were fortunate enough to get the money and buy the computer, and not only that, but we did find a pulsar that was orbiting around something else. Now, here's the first evidence that, in fact, that was what we had found. One of these pulsars that Hulse identified during his work there was different than all the rest in that its period, the interval between the pulses, as best we could measure it, was not quite constant. It was almost constant. They're typically constant to 6 or 7 or 8 or even more digits that you can write down after solving for the rotational period. But this one had a slightly variable period that was very easily reproducible. And we could do the simple calculation that any freshman physics student could do, that the change of period divided by the period gives you the velocity of this object relative to the speed of light. And it turned out to be a huge velocity, remarkable, 300 kilometers a second at maximum. That's 0.1% of the speed of light. Therefore, this thing was at least mildly into the relativistic regime of Einstein's theory, into the regime where effects that turn up in the equations at higher powers of v, the speed of the object, divided by c, the speed of light, higher powers than v over c to the first power. So this was astonishing, and we realized right away that this was an object that probably would turn out to have important applications, very different from those that we had imagined when we started the project. As you can see by the red curve down here at the bottom, the period that this thing goes through before it repeats is just a little bit under 8 hours, a third of a day. Therefore, these two stars are very close together. They're completing a whole orbit every 8 hours. It was easy to see, couldn't possibly be ordinary stars like the Sun, because if you put the Sun and another star like the Sun that close together so that their orbit could be that short, they would basically run into each other. They would clearly disrupt each other gravitationally. Probably they'd be touching. So these had to be, we knew one of them was a pulsar and therefore a very dense object. It was almost certain that the other object would also have to be a very dense object, more or less of the same kind. And it turns out that it's in fact, true, it's another neutron star. So here's where we were in 1974, September, October. We had discovered from our nice place here in the Caribbean a pair of objects some 25,000 light years away, as best we could estimate it. The distance was not accurately known, but it could be estimated pretty well, to be something like the same as the distance between the sun and the center of our galaxy. It was not in that direction, it was off in another direction. So it's a member of our galaxy, but not a close neighbor of ours in our galaxy. And it's going about around the other star at a very small distance, about 1 million kilometers. That's about equal to the size of about 1 million kilometers, which is about equal to the size of the sun. So two objects, very dense, going around each other. Well, it was almost right away that theorists started writing papers or calling us up and telling us, hey, there's this interesting effect that you should look for. And one of these interesting effects that we had, in fact, thought of also is that this system should radiate gravitational waves, according to Einstein's theory. Gravitational waves exist because even though in Newtonian physical theory, the force of one object on the other when they're orbiting each other propagates somehow magically instantaneously, according to relativity, nothing happens instantaneously. It has to propagate at a velocity which is less than or equal to the speed of light. And if that's the case, there should be generated a phenomenon basically analogous to the electromagnetic radiation we get when we chase electrons up and down a radio antenna to make radio waves. Here we're chasing masses around in a repetitive way that should generate gravitational waves. We could calculate the amount of that radiation and see how much energy it takes away from the system. If you take energy away from an orbiting system, the orbit should shrink, just the same way that an Earth satellite, a man-made satellite, will come closer to the Earth and eventually come back into the Earth's atmosphere if it loses some energy from its orbit. In this case, the amount by which the orbit should shrink, we calculated, was about 1 millimeter per orbit, even though the size of the orbit is 1 million kilometers. And some people have described it as the ultimate in scientific chutzpah to imagine that you could measure something as small as that. But in fact, it turns out we could measure it after some years, owing to the very high precision of the pulsar clock and the fortunate circumstance that this small effect builds up gradually over time. And after a few orbits, it's not very big, it gets bigger and bigger over time in such a way that it is measurable. Now, even so, even though I've already sort of tipped the scales and told you that this is going to be a measurable phenomenon, let's think for just a few minutes about what you might have thought told that we were going to go look for gravitational waves in this method. In fact, Einstein, shortly after generating his theory of general relativity, recognized that gravitational waves should exist, and he went through the exercise of estimating what would happen if you tried to do the experiment that Hertz had done with radio waves, but instead do it with gravitational waves. That is, make a gravitational wave transmitter and pick up the radiation with a gravitational wave receiver, perhaps on the other side of the laboratory or something, to see if it works. So there's a paper by Einstein in 1916 when he imagined having a motor with a shaft and a large bar on the shaft that you spin rapidly. That would generate gravitational waves, and you can calculate how much. And here's the equation that calculates how much. If A is the length of the bar, and R is the radius, and M is the mass, and omega is the velocity of rotation, the angular velocity of the motor, then this is the luminosity in gravitational waves that would be produced by such a thing. It obviously works better if you have a high mass and a big bar and a high speed on the motor. But the bad news is that out in front is this coefficient that has Newton's constant of gravity in the numerator. And all of you physics students know that big G is a small number. It's 10 to the minus 11 or something in the usual units that we use. And even worse news, C is the speed of light, and it's in the denominator, and it comes in at the fifth power. So this is a tiny coefficient. And if we put in the numbers of a steel bar, 1 meter in radius, 20 meters long, it weighs about 500 tons, spin it as fast as you can just before you reach the point at which the steel would fly apart from its own tensile strength limitations, and you get this tiny amount of energy out of this gravitational wave transmitter, about 10 to the minus 22 ergs per second. An erg is about the amount of energy it takes you to blink your eye once. this is nothing. There's basically no energy coming out because this coefficient is so small. And worse yet, if you wanted to build a receiver to pick up the waves from this transmitter, the receiver would have this same bad news coefficient in its equation as well. So it's even worse. So basically, an experiment to generate and receive gravitational waves in the laboratory on the Earth is impossible. Nobody's going to do it now, and nobody's going to do it in the future either, I think is safe to say. But nature is not constrained as we are. In nature, there are much bigger things that move fast, have high speeds and high velocities, high masses, and that she can do better than we can. So here's a pair of stars orbiting with a separation A, masses M1 and M2 and so forth. And if you put in the same equations and eliminate some consistent numbers from both of them, you end up with gravitational wave luminosity of a pair of stars, each equal to the mass of a neutron star, 1.4 solar masses, and in an orbit with a period of about 8 hours, just as the system is that we discovered. You discover that in this case, the luminosity is about 10 to the positive 31 instead of 10 to the negative 20, whatever that was, 20-something. It's a huge amount more. And in fact, this amount of energy is not negligible. The total amount of energy coming out of our sun in all wavelengths is only a couple of orders of magnitude bigger than that. So now we're talking about serious energy. It's very significant amounts. So maybe there is an astrophysical experiment that could do this, even if we can't possibly do it in the laboratory. Well, here's the way the experiment actually looks to a physicist's eye in sort of block diagram form. We have signals coming in from the radio telescope. They're amplified, they're converted, and sent into a spectrometer, which analyzes them by frequency. It puts them into a signal averaging device, which knows something about the expected pulsation interval because it knows the past behavior of this pulsar. That's been programmed into it with this computer. We have a bunch of stuff, all the things here connected by green lines, which keep track of time accurately within the experiment. And I'll say more about that in a minute. In any case, this system builds up a series of what we refer to as average profiles of the pulse. It's a kind of like an electrocardiogram of the pulsar. It gives a blip when the pulse goes by. And we want to record the times at which those blips arrived, the so-called, we call them TOAs, or times of arrival of the pulsar information at the telescope. Now, this timekeeping parts of the experiment turn out to be one of the critical determinants of the accuracy with which the measurements are made. And so for that, we need very accurate time at the observatory. And we have a good observatory clock. It's an atomic clock. It keeps, at that time in the 1970s and early 1980s, it kept time to an accuracy of about 1 microsecond, a millionth of a second per day. But we needed something that kept that kind of accuracy over more than a day, but over weeks and months and years even. And so we ended up getting one of the earliest GPS receivers, even before you could buy them to help you with your directions if you get lost. GPS was around, and we could get one to use to transfer time from national timekeeping laboratories, which had much better clocks than the one that we could afford to have at the Arecibo Observatory. And so we kept an accurate clock log, through the GPS system. We could compare the time according to our local clock with distant, much more accurate clocks kept on the Earth. And that allowed us to keep time in the experiment. So the analysis of the data looks something like this in cartoon form. We had the pulsar measured times of arrival. Topocentric just means at the observatory. So we measured the time at which the signal arrived at the observatory over many years, many cycles. We didn't, by the way, have to continually observe. We could go away, come back months later, observe it again, and pick up the train of pulses accurately enough that we knew we had not missed even a single pulse during that time. We could extrapolate out to know how long we could afford to be away before picking up the measurements again and make sure that we had not missed a beat somewhere. Therefore, we had kept accurate count of all the intervening pulses. We had to have these clock corrections that I just described. We had to have a pretty accurate, relativistically accurate model of the solar system. And it turns out that, fortunately for us, this was being developed at about the same time by people at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory because they needed it for interplanetary navigational purposes. Because we needed to know precisely where the telescope was when these pulses arrived there, because we had to refer everything to some reference point for which we used the so-called Barry Center, or center of mass of the whole solar system. That's a good local reference point to use as the place in which all of the equations are going to be written in the reference frame of. Okay, we had to have, interestingly, Earth rotation data. We know the Earth turns every 24 hours, right? But it's not exactly 24 hours. It actually varies a little bit. The Earth, after all, is not a rigid, solid sphere. It's got a molten core and oceans and atmosphere sloshing around, so the rotation is a little bit variable. It's why, from time to time, we have a leap second that allows the civil timekeeping services to make up for the fact that the Earth has accumulated a little bit of extra rotation, or is missing a little bit of rotation that it would have had if it had been going at a constant rate. Not to worry. If you're an astronomer doing an experiment like this, all you need to do is to subscribe to a service known as the International Earth Rotation Service and ask for them to send you Bulletin B. And then every 2 weeks you get an email from the IERS now with information about the last 2 weeks of Earth rotation observations that have been made. So we can keep track of exactly where we are in the rotational phase by keeping track of that. And then there's a complicated analysis program that amounts to turning the crank in this meat grinder, and out of that comes a bunch of model parameters that tell us what we're looking for, and a bunch of post-fit residuals which tell us basically things about what our measurement accuracy is and what kind of systematics we might have to allow for in analyzing the data. Now, I'm not going to say anything much about these equations other than to show you that they exist, and to mention that on the right-hand sides of these equations all come from relativity theory. On the right-hand sides, the way I have written them, appear the mass of the pulsar, M1, the mass of the other star, M2, which initially we don't know, right? So we're going to have to solve for those from this experiment. We have E, the eccentricity of the orbit. If you remember that very first curve that I showed you with the deep dips and then a gradual hump in the center indicating the velocity of the pulsar, those indicate right away that this is not a circular orbit. If it were circular, you would see a sine wave, very smooth, right? This has got very high harmonic content, a very deep, sharp dip. That means the orbit is highly eccentric, and it's an ellipse, an elongated ellipse. And that's good for us because that makes this term very much larger. It means that this is going to generate more gravitational waves by a lot than it would if the system were a circular orbit. What else? The eccentricity we can measure accurately. The orbital period we can measure accurately. Big T is just a constant. It's a certain number of microseconds. All the things on the left-hand side, then, are parameters which, in principle, we can measure from relativistic effects in the orbital dynamics. And if we can measure them, we should be able to plot them up in a graph where the axes of the graph are the initially unknown masses of the pulsar and the other star. And if this system is, if our experiment is correct and the system is behaving the way relativity theory says it should, then the curve applying to each one of those five parameters had better all pass through the same point on this two-dimensional graph. And here's the graph that results from those measurements. And as you can see, the curves, each of which has a different shape, do indeed all pass through the same point to within the accuracy that you can see it on this scale. They tell us that the mass of the pulsar is 1.4 times the mass of the sun, very nearly. The mass of the other star is also 1.4 times the mass of the sun, very nearly. These are two neutron stars, just about at the mass given by the famous Chandrasekhar limit, the upper mass limit for white dwarfs. It is roughly the mass that all supernova remnants all neutron stars have. There's one other parameter, one other way of graphically seeing the results of the experiment, and that is to look again at the details giving rise to this particular parameter. The little dot over the PB, the PB is the period of the binary orbit. It's the thing which is about 8 hours, 7 hours, 0.7 something. And the little dot over it means it's the rate of change of that quantity. The orbit is gradually getting shorter because the two stars are gradually coming closer together, this 1 millimeter per orbit that I was talking about earlier. And that gives rise to a predictable shortening over time of the orbital period. And that's what we can measure, and is shown in this graph. Over time, starting from back when the initial measurements were made in late 1974 up until a couple of years ago when the last measurements that are plotted on this graph are shown, the quantity that we can measure is gradually getting bigger and bigger according to this quadratic expression here. And the agreement of the observations given by the little dots with their error flags on them and the predicted curve is just remarkable. It's to within a fraction of 1% over all these years. Well, that basically is what this experiment was all about and why it turned out to be such a fascinating experiment. It showed that gravitational waves, in fact, do exist. They are carrying energy away from this system at just the rate that that relativity theory predicts in the shape of that curve. It shows that this orbital system is shrinking. We could calculate, in fact, how long it's going to take before the two stars will basically run into each other and the system will have some major fireworks. That will be about 300 million years from now, which is a long time, but actually, astronomically speaking, is a pretty short time. It's much less than the age of the Earth or the age of the Sun. It's much less than the age of the universe. It is, on a short time scale, cosmologically speaking, these things must be happening, not only this one, but others elsewhere in the universe. And when they do come to that endpoint, there will be a big output of gravitational radiation in the last few hours. There are instruments being built here in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world that hope to detect that kind of radiation directly. Now, here's just an artist's sketch of the kind of phenomena that we're talking about when we talk about gravitational waves. If we have a couple of masses in here orbiting around each other, they are effectively distorting the local space and time fabric, if you like, in just the kind of way that's attempted to be illustrated by that sketch. It stretches space in one direction first and then in another direction at 90 degrees to that in a way that if you set up an appropriate detector on the Earth, you might actually be able to see these things happening from some gravitational waves generated in some distant part of the universe. And very precise measurement apparatus has been put together at several different places in the world now to try to detect just that kind of a phenomenon. The acronyms that you see there at the top of that slide, LIGO for Laser Interferometer Gravity Wave Observatory, Virgo, LIGO, by the way, is a U.S. Effort. It's got an instrument in Louisiana and another one in Washington State, two of them. Virgo is a French-Italian collaboration built in northern Italy. GEO is a British and German instrument in Germany. There are also efforts going on in Japan, TAMA, and in Australia, the Australian Interferometer Gravity Wave Observatory. And actually, the Australians are not on the air yet. The Japanese have come up fairly recently and are starting to achieve sensitivities that are of interest in this kind of discovery as well. So major efforts are being made now to actually try to detect this kind of radiation directly instead of proving that it existed indirectly through an experiment like the one I just described for you. And there are on the books other ambitious projects. I'll just mention one of them. It's known as LISA, the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, a proposal made to NASA 10 years or so ago. Still has not been approved as a project that is underway, but is still on the books. It may well. People are hoping now for a launch as early as 2015. That may, in view of current economic crises and other things, turn out to be over-optimistic, but it may happen at some point. And this major instrument out in Earth orbit would in some ways be far more sensitive than LIGO, but to a different frequency range of gravitational waves. So that will also be a fascinating thing that may well happen in future. Well, I think this is, it's been a pleasure addressing you on these things. I think we've had enough of it at this point. I'm going to stop, and if there are questions, I would be more than pleased to answer some. Thank you so much for your attention.
Okay, questions for Professor Taylor.
Okay.
We'll go back to your introduction of the pulsar itself. Why does this spinning body made up primarily of neutrons produce electromagnetic?
Yeah. Good question. It is made up of, you know, it's heavily neutron enriched, much more so than ordinary matter. But in fact, the interior, it turns out, is almost certainly a superconductor. So there are strong magnetic effects frozen in from its infancy. Therefore, currents flowing there, though, that will keep the magnetic field strong for a sizable number of years, and that basically makes the star a spinning magnet. And all the electron phenomena that we observe externally to the object are generated by the strong electrical forces created by that rotating magnet. Yeah, all the way in the back. Okay, so I think the question is, are there black holes, do you mean in the center of a neutron star? Yeah, well, no, but a neutron star is sort of the last step in making more and more dense matter, just short of becoming a black hole. If a neutron star were made about 50% more dense, there would be no return. It would become a black hole. If a neutron star accreted somewhere between one-half and one additional solar mass of matter, perhaps it runs into something major. Or perhaps these two stars, when they, 300 million years from now, run into each other. Then the total mass of the whole system will be 2.8 solar masses instead of the present 1.4 in each of two pieces. And as far as we understand it, 2.8 solar masses is too big, too massive to be supported stably as a neutron star. That would almost certainly become a black hole. So this is very close to black hole physics, but it's not quite there yet at the present stage. Yes?
Why are the neutron stars always at the charge state power limit?
Yeah, okay, so the question was, why are the neutron star masses always very close to the Chandrasekhar limit? And the answer is, in pretty simple terms, is that this famous limit postulated by the Indian physicist Chandrasekhar in about 1934, when he was concerned about the masses of so-called white dwarf stars. He recognized that there's a physical principle of very dense matter that would make a stable configuration of stellar material a stopping point where gravitational forces would be overcome by some other force that was able to counteract them adequately to make a stable object, at a limit where you basically have squeezed the electrons in the system as much as you can squeeze them by, and there's a limit there caused by quantum mechanical exclusion. You can't put, according to quantum mechanics laws, more than so many similar objects in a given space. Anyway, that creates a basic ultimate limit of how dense you can make something, as long as it still has separate electrons in it. When a very massive star goes through its nuclear fusion processes to a certain level, so that the core of the star reaches that point, the mass of the Chandrasekhar limit, it becomes unable to support itself any longer against the force of gravity. And that's what causes a supernova explosion. And basically, the center, which is self-defined to be the region within a zone that is dominated by this Chandrasekhar limit, that continues to fall inward. The amount of energy released by that effect is enough to blow off all the outer layers of the star. And so the outer, it might be 8 or 10 or more solar masses of matter, is blown off as a big cloud of glowing gas, and the inner part is what's left over, and that's the neutron star. So the neutron star basically occurs because the core gets to a point where it slightly exceeds the Chandrasekhar limit, and that's the amount that's left. There's a little bit of mass lost during the explosion. There's a little bit of mass carried away by the neutrinos that occurred during the explosion. So you end up with something just a little bit less than this 1.4 solar mass limit. Okay, back here.
Do we know the ratio of a neutron star's density to the mass
Do we know the ratio of neutron star density
to the Planck
density? Well, yeah, we know it basically because we know what the, I mean, the Planck limit is something which is not an observable limit. It's a combination of physical constants that gives you a number that is of probably very significant, highly significant in the very early universe at the time of the Big Bang. But it's not a number that we can measure in the laboratory. We know it only by combining some fundamental constants. The density of a neutron star can be essentially determined by measuring the mass and the and the radius. And we have an accurate measurement now of masses, not so accurate measurements of the radius, but we know it to within better than a factor of two, and therefore we know the density of nuclear matter. It's not very different from the density of nuclear matter in the laboratory, which can also be measured. So we know that ratio. Yes. Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot less. Right. Okay, back here.
Are there many binary neutron stars, and how do you suppose they came to be anyway?
Okay, good question. So are there a lot of binary neutron stars, binary pulsars, and how do they get that way? The answer is yes, there are a lot, but it's a small fraction of all of the known pulsars. There are over 1,000, but less than 2,000 pulsars known now. There are 100 and some known pulsars in binary systems. Of those binary pulsars, only a small fraction of those are neutron star pairs. Most of the rest are a neutron star in orbit with a white dwarf, another dense star, but not as dense. It's something more like the mass of the sun and the radius of the Earth instead of the radius of only 20 miles or so. So a significantly different kind of system. But there are quite a number of binary pulsars known. There is one system known now, it's been known only for about 4 or 5 years, where not only are both objects neutron stars, they are both active pulsars that we can receive pulses from. So that has given rise to a new set of experiments that may over time become even more accurate than this one. In any case, they will also be able to measure additional parameters that we were not able to measure because we could only measure the signals from one of these moving objects instead of from both of them. Okay, yes? I'm afraid I wasn't catching enough of that to get the question, so maybe can you say it a little louder? Yeah, okay, I think I get the thrust of your question, which is how can you end up with neutron stars with masses only about equal to that of the sun or a little bit more when you start out with stars that are much more massive than that? These stars originated with total masses, probably 8, 10, 12 solar masses. Most of that material is lost during the supernova explosion. Only a little bit is left behind.
But, like, how can they get so close? How can they form so close to each other?
How can they form so close to each other? Okay, do I have it right? Yeah. The answer is they didn't. That's a very good question, too. If they originated with much bigger masses, wouldn't they have been touching at that point if they were that close together? Good question. Okay. So they started much farther apart. It's pretty obvious they must have. what happens to a binary star system as it evolves, as we best understand these things? Well, if the stars are massive enough, they will burn up the stuff in the nuclear activities going on in the core, lose some energy that way, eventually reach a point where they cannot any longer support their weight, basically, and so something has to become unstable. That's at the point where some mass loss will take place, and eventually, if the star is massive enough, it may undergo a supernova explosion. Now, when it does that, the orbit is significantly modified. If there is frictional losses of energy, then the orbit can actually shrink. It can shrink a lot, bringing the two stars closer together, and that can happen at the time when this, supposing the first star has already gone, exploded as a supernova, left a neutron star, still with a fairly wide orbit, then when the second one gets to the point where it is going to lose matter, it probably will swell up and become something known as a red giant for a while. That will cause the two stars to be almost touching, and that will cause frictional losses that will make them move closer together. They'll lose a lot of angular momentum and energy during that time, and some of the outer material from the second star will be lost, and the orbit will shrink by a lot. Then when the second star undergoes a supernova explosion, they may be left in that very tight, close orbit. And that's how we think a pair can end up in this very small binary orbit. But that's a great question. How about over here? Yep.
If we could hear these gravity waves, what would they sound like? What frequencies
are Yeah. Okay. Great question. I think the answer is, the frequency in this case would be one half of the orbital frequency, the orbital motion. So we're talking about 8 hours. Half of that is 4 hours. So this would be a very low tone, a fraction of one cycle per second, one over 4 hours, basically. Later on, as they get closer and closer together, the frequency will rise. And when they're just about at the point where they're going to coalesce to form a black hole, they will be moving then at a orbital period of about a millisecond. So the frequency then would be about a kilohertz, 1,000 hertz. That's an easily audible tone. So at the very end, there will be a very strong, rapidly rising pitch of gravitational waves. If you transform that into an audible signal, you would hear a whistling chirp that goes up in frequency and ends with a big bang, if you like. But that's the sort of frequency. The frequency range to which the LIGO telescope is sensitive is anywhere from a few tens of hertz up to a few kilohertz. So those are audible frequencies. I don't think I've heard of any of the scientists there sitting around with earphones on listening to these, because the data all goes into the computer or something. But you could imagine, if and when they detect signals, you could imagine them translating that into an audible signal, and that would be something that you could hear. Yes? Okay, so the question was basically what kinds of things emit gravity waves. Could a large object that's not rotating do it, or could light waves somehow convert into gravity waves? The answer is what you need is something which is asymmetrical and which oscillates or rotates in some way. I mean, it's pretty closely analogous to the generation of electromagnetic radiation. A radio transmitter works by forcing electrical currents to flow in wires or in antennas and making electrons move back and forth. Those things oscillate, that generates waves. If you could make masses oscillate in some way, they would generate gravitational waves. And the orbital system does that fine, and that is a kind of an oscillation. If you spin something rapidly, just a single spherical object, that will not generate gravitational waves because it is symmetrical about the axis of symmetry. But if you think of something more elongated, like a football, and put an axis through the short diameter of the football, so the ends are sticking out here, and then rotate that, that'll radiate gravitational waves.
I guess what I meant was, if you just have a large object going across the sky, would it leave like a wake, or does it
yeah.
orbital
period? Yes, it would. That would not be a periodic gravitational wave. It would be more like a pulse, but yes, it would do that. And conversion of light, well, yes, that's possible in principle, but it would it's hard to imagine light doing that at a level that would be a significant amount of gravitational radiation. I mean, photons are not very massive. They do have mass. They move rapidly. That's all good. But they're not going to radiate a lot of gravitational waves. Yes, sir? Yeah, that's precisely correct.
Have they yet actually confirmed gravity waves yet?
Well, I think the confirmation of the existence is not in question. That is, you know, directly a result of the experiment I described for you. If you mean, has anyone detected a gravity wave in a detector on the Earth, the answer is no, not yet. I mean, LIGO and the other instruments like that have been mostly in engineering tests and preparation for observations, but they have had several significant science runs so far. They have looked for known objects that should or might emit gravitational waves with some known properties to see if they could find those. They knew that the probability of there being enough of gravitational radiation from those systems to see them with present sensitivity was not very high, but it was worth looking anyway. They haven't seen it yet. So far, they have upper limits. They know that, say, they've looked at some nearby pulsars. If a pulsar is spinning rapidly on its axis, has a little bump on one side, that'll radiate gravity waves, and it could be significant. And actually, they have upper limits that show that these things are very smooth. There are not little bumps on one side of a 10-kilometer pulsar higher than a few millimeters in some of these objects. They're very smooth. Well, that's not terribly surprising because they're so dense that they've got to be smooth, basically, at that level of density. But anyway, the answer is no. Those signals have not directly been measured in the laboratory yet, and we hope they will be. Yeah, well, the question is about the ultimate significance of these things. I think you are pretty much asking me the Queen Victoria question. What is it good for, or what are we going to learn from it? And, you know, I have to answer, I don't know what the significance may turn out to be eventually. What we do know is that science has progressed over the centuries by a series by applying what we like to call the scientific method, where you form hypotheses, you think you have some understanding of at least some portion of the kinds of phenomena that you're interested in. You can, from those hypotheses, make predictions about what should happen in certain circumstances, an experiment perhaps, or a natural circumstance where you could just go and make a passive observation, such as we did with the binary pulsar. And you try to do those experiments or observations and see if the hypothesis gave you the right prediction. And if it did, you say that, well, the theory seems to pass that test. It doesn't necessarily mean that the theory is the last story on the subject that will ever be uttered. It just means that so far, so good. This seems to be describing what we can observe, and we don't have to discard this idea yet. We know, by the way, that there is a fundamental problem in physics because deep down at the microscopic level, we know that physics obeys the rules of quantum mechanics, and gravity is not a quantum theory, and it is not amenable to any kind of adjustment that would make it into a quantum theory. So it's a purely, so what a physicist would call a classical theory. It applies to regimes that are not microscopic, and somehow, as we try to, you know, translate into microscopic terms or into terms of the very early universe when things were much smaller and much denser, the theory may have limitations that we don't know about yet. So one of the ways in which you make progress is to try to push existing theory as far as you can at the limits. You try to see if there are any clouds on the horizon, places where maybe we haven't tested yet and we ought to have a look. And the notion that gravity should be the phenomenon of gravity, which we ordinarily experience only in basically static circumstances that do not involve radiation. But we knew that 100 years ago, when relativity came out, almost 100 years ago, that there should be gravitational radiation in physics. We just weren't able to test it throughout most of the 20th century. And by the discovery of this binary pulsar, we turned out we could do that, and we could test it, and therefore get a confirmation of a part of our best theory of gravitation, which had never before been amenable to testing. Now it has been, so one more thing we know that really does exist and was predicted by our existing theories. I think we probably have got people that
that sounds like a wonderful place to end.
It's a good place to end.
I just wanted to remind you that we will be observing tonight at Angel Hall, so if you are interested in doing that, please gather at that side where the Student Astronomical Society is also selling t-shirts, correct? So if you'd like a Student Astronomical t-shirt, please stop by for these wonderful souvenirs and mementos.